science, most advanced civilizations in the medieval and early modern period. So all this information, and most of the stuff, like over 1 million, up to 5 million manuscripts and books are known just around Timbuktu alone. And only 18 have been deciphered so far. And a lot of it, some of it is in local African languages.
Yeah.
As well, too, not just Arabic. So there was an Africanization of all of this as well. So it's like when the Arabs, when they got the information from the Egyptians and the Greeks, when they brought the information back into Africa, the Africans further advanced the knowledge as well. So it's quite interesting that the whole story of Africa and the world has to be rewritten once we start deciphering a lot of this information.
Well, that is what history is. Mm-hmm. You see, it is, so far, we have hit upon a period of bias where lies, you know, are told to say that people had no history and so on and so forth. But all that that has done is rob us as humanity of our heritage. That is all it has done. So, in time, yes. I do have to go on, but I thank you. I wish you had called earlier because this is, you know, an interesting, let me say, subject matter.
Yeah, and great things are happening in South Africa, too. I wanted to mention that about the high-speed train as to being developed in South Africa and developing there and so forth.
But, indeed, but yeah. I do have to go. But yeah. Thank you very much. Huh?
Next time.
Thank you. Indeed, next time. And I want to thank you all for tuning in, listening. For the people who call, thank you so much. And stay tuned for Jim Freund with Hour of the Wolf, who comes up immediately after. You've been listening to Labrish. My name is Haptah Selassie. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest and is a Jazzmac production, with assistance from Seduzo Kaimbili. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. One love, walk good. Until next week, Mr. Tosh.
Got to build our love on one foundation. Got to build our love. No love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. Got to put aside name organization. Got to put aside.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, with me, somebody whose name is Elia Dawn Johnson, novelist, short story writer, just a cool person. Stay tuned. Thank you.
the question. She says, what a great suggestion. Everything is hotsy-totsy now. No more sighing, no more crying. I'm through with the blues. Don't you love me? Heard it of me. Hey, 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 how? Got myself a brand new hotsy. She's my hotsy. I'm her hotsy.
There we go. The controls. The mic may have been on, but it didn't light up. And if it doesn't light up, you don't know if you're on the radio or not. But now I know, and presumably so do you. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And yes, we're in that blessed, and you know when I'm using the word blessed, I mean anything but two-week period, in which we have to log every bleeping, and when I say the word bleeping, you know I mean bleeping song that is played. But thanks to our to Sean, our wonderful operations director, he has enabled me that if I write it all down now, okay, that was Black Bottom, then I can put it in later. But I don't know who performed it, and you're supposed to log like the label. I mean, I don't know the label. But you see, what I can do now is go home and look it up. The idea was is that during the show, I'm supposed to be like going to Wikipedia or something and looking all of this up. I kid you not. And this is all why the copyright police. And we don't do that. It's not about broadcasting. It's about streaming the show over the internet. That's why we have to follow these rules. And if we don't do that, then Pacifica doesn't follow through on some CPB, that's the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, an organization founded by Spiro T. Agnew in the 70s. Yes, you heard me right. So, you know, then we wouldn't be in good standing. Oh, I understand. I don't understand. But whatever. Good morning. Let's get off that topic, shall we? Let's do announcements. Let's see. Readings. Okay, the entire season for the New York Review of Science Fiction series is over, right? It's done with, right? Wrong. Not when I get a phone call saying, oh, it's too bad your series is over because Paolo Bacigalupi is going to be in town. It's like, okay, series isn't over. Paolo won the Nebula Award this year for best novel, for The Wind-Up Girl. He writes something, he gets awards. That's what this guy does. He writes, everybody says, that's fabulous. And, well, it is. So two things. Number one is he will be the guest here in 2 weeks on July 3rd. And I have to vehemently thank David J. Williams for allowing me for the second time to move him around. David will be on the last Saturday in July, talking about the third novel in his trilogy, The Machinery of Light, which has been getting wonderful notices. Thank you, David, for allowing this flexibility. Right now he's in L.A., promoting the book. There's actually a budget. I don't know if he's supplying it or if the publisher is supplying it, but somebody's paying for him to go around the country and promote his novel, which is way cool.
Yeah.
So, but what's even cooler is that David was very giving. The book technically came out in May, and so you're supposed to promote these within, oh, a year or so of the book coming out. And we moved him once because of our now, thankfully, over fundraising drive. And now had to move him, or rather hoped to be able to move him again. And he said, well, I would never stand in the way of another writer being on the air, which was just lovely. So thank you, David J. Williams. So he'll be on at the end of July, and Paolo Bacigalupi will be here in the first Saturday in July. And then we will revive the New York Review of Science Fiction readings for 1 month, for July 6th is the first, 7-6, oh. Right, is the first Saturday, first, God help me, Tuesday of the month. And so we will do that at 138 Sullivan Street at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. And I had a couple of choices in mind as to who to team up with Paolo. And I had seen, okay, there was this whole thing where one could go to the gallery and watch the Nebula Awards.
All right.
And Alaya, our guest this morning, was very, being a Nebula nominee, was very much the, well, like the only reason that you know, the thing continued at least until 10 to find out who won the short story. Oh, no, Nora. It was Nora. Well,
Nora.
I'm sorry. Yes,
yeah.
It was Nora. But you were, no, you weren't there at all, were you?
No.
No, it was.
Well, I wasn't in town.
It was Nora. Now, where were you?
I wasn't in New York. I think I.
Yeah, now I'm remembering. You know, which so seldom happens that Freud remembers anything relevant to the world. But no, yeah, it was Nora. But what I saw on that screen was I saw very briefly Paolo Bacigalupi talking to Saladin Ahmed.
Oh.
And so Saladin will be the co-reader. It's just like that. Became clear to me. I know why I was conflating the two of you. I'll tell you off the air. Well, actually, it was because I was thinking of you as the other reader. I knew it was going to be either you or Saladin. And I'm sorry to tell you this. It's because I knew you were going to be on the air here.
I see. It's okay. But, Saladin is an awesome writer. He's also
he's
in my
wonderful.
Writing group. So
yes. Yes, he was in a different writing group, and then he went to the younger group.
Yes, the younger group. He's
making everybody in the, like Rick Bowes, in the first writing group going, ouch. But Saladin is wonderful, and he was very good about it and all that. And he has twins to deal with now. Oh, my God. Regular listeners will remember him. He was on this program about 9 months ago. Or something like that, and will be on the show again but this will be actually his first time as a member of Altered Fluid, right?
He was a member the last time we did it, but he couldn't do the show. So
oh.
I think this is the first time that he'll be on the air doing the show with us as a member of Altered Fluid.
Okay, yeah. So, yes, you see, my memory is slowly, slowly coming back. I think I have to go back to not taking naps before the show, just sleeping real late on Friday when I can and staying awake through the night. That might alleviate my...
Or at least make you not realize it.
Oh, yes, there we go. Exactly. So, is that in flashbacks? But anyway... I'm not going there. We're talking about reruns. It's radio, right? Anyway, so sure. And just keep believing that. Right. Okay, so I mean, that's really just and also either way would have been an extremely cool lineup. But this time it will be Saladin, and we're going to get you to read there again because we've now embarked on an Altered Fluid series.
Right.
Yeah, because I can't just have three. because we had Eugene, Devin, and Nora.
Right.
Last month. And there's, what, 11 people in the group?
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll have to, as we did with the Tabula Rasa group, when we had them read at NIRSIF, we did two readings to get a few of them in there between, you know, Mary Robinette Cowell, who was still in the group and all that. So this, so we'll have to do like three readings. Oh, and I haven't even told you, Aliyah, that I've got the whole series sort of planned out for the rest of the year, and when we come back in September. September is a couple of possibilities. October, early October, the first Tuesday in October, our guest curator will be Rose Fox.
Oh.
Which I'm very self-congratulatory about asking her.
That's a great, great idea.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, are you going to do better than somebody from PW or just Rose Fox to begin
right.
with, whether she was with Publishers Weekly or not? And she doesn't have confirmations yet on the people she's got, but they're cool.
Ooh.
California people, and they're cool.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
So that means that what I had originally in mind, which involved you, Aliyah, for the early October reading, instead will all of a sudden, in our little lines here, assuming that we get Cherie Renee Thomas, who would be the co-curator, to agree to this, would be you and Terrence Taylor and L.A. Banks and Linda Addison.
Oh.
Black vampires.
Yes.
Or vampires from the African diaspora. I don't have any name.
What are we going to call this? We've been calling it, I heard something about this. Terrence was calling it kind of hilariously Black Vampire Weekend.
Yes, right. And I've just been saying Black Vamps. And Terrence and I were on the phone yesterday, 4 hours in two sessions at least. But my God, can he and I dish. And thank God we have Bluetooth. We wore out batteries.
I can only imagine.
You know, and I'm talking about, what are you doing now? I'm chopping onions. Oh, what are you doing? We had a great time. But at any rate, and he also doesn't know this, the movie, See the Things of Blues. So we had a lot to talk about. At any rate, so this is our idea for late October in the series. So I don't have the exact date yet, but it'll be
as long as it isn't over World Fantasy.
Ah, I do have to take that into account. Yeah, but no, World Fantasy should be what, the last weekend?
Yeah, it's like Halloween weekend.
Yeah, well, so. Halloween
or whatever, like the, you know,
Halloween's a Sunday, I think.
Yeah, it goes over the 31st.
So this will be like, I'm thinking the Tuesday before.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I might. That's entirely possible that I will be running a half marathon 2 days before that.
Oh, my God. I mean, this is what we did to Nora. Poor Nora was at WISCON.
Oh.
Got off the plane, came to do the reading at NYRSIF, and I said, hi, we're all going out to here. Aren't you coming with us, to my ladies? And she was like, huh?
Yeah. Oh, right. I remember that.
She's a trooper.
Yeah.
And she did a very good reading.
Yeah, that's a great reading.
Yeah, yeah. So that'll be your turn.
Yeah.
So we'll have you up there at least twice over the next year. So
sounds good to me.
So getting back, by the way, if anybody wants to know more, my website is like dead at the moment, but nevertheless, you can go to ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, and there's more information. Or if you want to join my mailing list, which is just for the reading series, it's nothing to do with the radio show or anything, send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or follow my Twitter feed. Jim Freund, FREUND, at twitter.com. You can just find me there, and you can be sure that I'm always mentioning who's. I don't tweet that much, but when I do, it's who's going to be on the radio show, and where you can listen to the archive after the show, and who's going to be reading at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. And once again, so that's Paolo Bacigalupi and Saladin Ahmed. Well, I think I said it right. There's a thing in Ahmed.
Yeah.
I know if it were Jewish, it would be Ahmed. It would be that little ch, but
right.
It's not. Barbara Nimri Aziz here is mm-hmm. always like, no, you have to aspirate. You don't go ch. It's the same thing, but you don't. The ch, it's a ha, right?
Huh. Yeah, I don't know.
It's not easy for American voices. It doesn't come naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And Saladin says, well, of course, it's a Hamid. I can't. It's not Hamid. You know, it's
right.
It's Ahmed. So I'll just say Saladin Ahmed. He's great.
Yes.
Come see him read. Admission is free, but I'll ask you for donations, or Barbara will anyway. Okay, I've wasted half an hour now. No, I haven't. But let's talk. But enough about me. What do you think we know? This is your second time solo on the show.
It is.
And the first time was when your first novel came out.
Right.
Which was when?
2007.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I can't believe
you're telling me it's 3 years?
Well, it was the fall of 2007, so 2 years.
Two and a half years.
Yeah, yeah.
We should have had you on here earlier. That's not right.
It took me a while to get the next books out, I guess. So.
Yes, I know. I don't care. Yeah, I'm always telling you people being writers, I'm always telling writers, it's like, yeah, okay, fine, you've got a book to promote, and I'm happy to work with you, getting you on the show so that you can promote the book. All I want is a good show. So, have you written any short stories, lady? A new paragraph. Come on the show.
Tell me
about that. I mean, people, if we were talking about this off the air, people tweet.
Oh.
How many words they've written a day?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I swear, if people could count their LiveJournal posts and their Twitters as their word count, everybody would be clocking 3,000 words except for me. But, I mean, it's incredible.
You're the only person in your writers group, I think. You and Matt are the only people who don't say what your word count that day is.
Oh, I mean, I
got 400 words today. Yay me. You
know? No, I don't. I can't imagine anyone caring. I mean, I can't imagine even my mom caring. So I just... every once in a while, I'll have some crazy day where I clock in 6,000 words, and I might tell people about that. But I mean, otherwise, I don't.
Yeah, right.
You know,
6,000 words. Wow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are rare days. Yeah, that's more like when I see the light at the end of the tunnel of a novel I'm working on, I will often like start clocking in like really big word counts, just trying to like get to the end of it.
Right.
So, that's the only time that happens. I'm not like. I never, like, sit around, eat lunch. Some people, they just have word counts by breathing. I just don't understand how they can possibly write that much.
yeah, but we don't know what those words are.
True. Some of them we do because they post, they have, you know, 500 word posts on LiveJournal that day or something.
Yeah, and what was the Samuel Johnson method was 100 words a day? Whatever you do, write 100 words a day.
That sounds doable. Right now, I'm going for 1,000. I'm not always succeeding. But I'm trying to do a.
That's two flash fiction stories.
Well, you know, Stephen King said, that's actually really interesting. Like his book on writing. I don't know if you read it, but
no,
it's a really good book. Actually, like yeah. I was actually like kind of interested.
Well, he knows the craft.
But I found his method and like his the most interesting thing about that book to me was how clear it was how much that worked for him, how competent he was, like, and I love the stuff, the biographical details. I loved how it was kind of like part memoir, part writing advice, but like how little it could work for me. Like when he was talking about how he never plots and he just keeps going and just does 2,000 words a day and just lets the story talk to him. And I just thought about that.
Or depending on the story, another writer.
Works. Right. And I remember just thinking, how... I have no
idea.
I'm
just saying, The Running Man, Prize of Peril, you know, King Sheckley. Anyway. Sorry, go on.
But, you know, I mean, I feel like this explains novels like The Stand, which just, you know, you can see, like, there's really great stuff there, but it's giant. Yeah. It's just, and I always try to, like, steer away from giantness, and I feel the only way to do that is to pre-plan.
Yeah.
In some ways,
yeah,
I don't.
They'll spin it as epic.
Right.
But
it's
giant.
I think.
And you and I like both, we were talking about this, we both like the long form.
Yes.
But
it has to be justified. Exactly. My favorite thing is a big book that justifies its length. I rarely read big books that really are justified at that length. You know, Guy Gavriel Kaye is a writer who can write a big book and I can feel totally.
He really manages
He's so good. Jonathan Strange is a perfect example of a book that is huge. It is huge. And if you looked at it, 99 out of 100 fantasy novels that are that big, I'd say, you know, you could cut some of this. Every word.
I'm still waiting for that movie, by the way.
Are they going to make one?
Well, Susanna sold the rights
to...
I get to call her Susanna because she's done the show twice. Oh. I'm very proud. The week the book came out, she was on this show.
That's a coup.
And she did a reading. She did an immersive reading. I'm very, very proud of that.
Oh, I wish I had seen that.
I should rebroadcast that.
Yeah, that's great. I saw her at Barnes & Noble. But I'm sure it wasn't
as
nice.
She's a great reader.
She was just amazing. I remember that.
I mean, I've seen Christina Pickles, fine actress, perform from Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell at Symphony Space.
Oh.
And her reading was not better than Susanna's.
Huh. That's great.
And Christina Pickles is a great reader.
Yeah, that book was just, I was blown away by that book. It's huge, and I read it in 2 days. I just went through it. Yeah. It was great.
It was a phenomenon when it came out, and I was absolutely, the publisher, who is Bloomsbury, same publisher as the Harry Potter books.
Right.
So they saw this as a new entry, although they knew it wasn't going to be an ongoing series in the same manner.
Right.
But they saw this as something worthy of that same kind of promotion, which confused people because it's not a book for young people. Young people can read it, but they won't necessarily fully comprehend the end.
The end
is not a simple, it's a novel. Right. It's a classic novel.
You know, and they're making so many allusions. I mean, it's so deeply literate. I loved that book.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It took her 10 years to write. And I mean, just the marginalia in that book. I love that book. I so love that book.
Really great.
And but when we were on the air, she was all talking about it, and then the possibility of a movie, and then the rights were bought with. Now I'm blanking on the name of the writer who wrote Dangerous Liaison.
I don't know.
I'll look it up. He writes a lot of screenplays.
Okay.
Yeah, he did the adaptation.
Right. I was
popular with Malkovich and
yeah, I love that movie too.
Christopher Hampton.
Oh, okay.
And Christopher Hampton was attached to the movie.
Wow.
For Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, second best choice. My best choice would have been Tom Stoppard.
Oh, well, that would have been perfect. Yeah. Here's the thing, though. Whenever I hear about a book that I love being turned into a movie, with very few exceptions,
you cringe.
I just go, but a book is not a movie.
You're like-minded, yes.
A book is not a movie. They're not the same thing. And to me, the literary form or the prose form that is most like a movie is short fiction. A short story is a movie. A novel is a miniseries.
Yes.
And so every time I hear The Golden Compass or anything is being turned into a movie, even if the best people are attached.
And Tom Stoppard did write The Golden Compass.
Right.
That was thrown out the window.
Yeah. Go write his screenplay. Well, that was brilliant plans, studio executives. That really worked out for you. But
yeah.
And
I'm the one who thought that Chris Weitz did a decent job, except they didn't let him make... The problem with that movie is it's about 90 minutes too short.
That is the problem with all of these. People really like the Harry Potter movies. I don't have a huge objection to them, but I remember I stopped kind of watching them after the fifth one because I was watching it. And I really...
That's about where I stopped.
I liked the fifth book. I mean, it wasn't like... It was. I think the third one is her best. The fifth one I enjoyed because I love.
Oh my God! We really are in sync here. Yeah. The third one's the best movie.
The third one is the best movie too. I love the Weasley twins. So the fifth book was really happy for me because there was lots of Weasley twin in it. But I remember watching the movie and thinking, oh, I recognize this scene. Oh, I recognize this character. But having a clear conception that, the events of this movie would make zero sense to you if you had not read the book. I mean, I saw it with my boyfriend at the time, and he had never read them. And he was like, well, it's pretty. I mean, you could tell, he had no idea what through line was. I basically realized it was postcards from the book.
Yeah.
That the problem is when you make a movie of a book and, the book is good, it has a following, and so you try to be really faithful to it, it's always a disaster because they're not the same form. And I feel almost like you have to be, it would be better to make a movie adaptation of a bad book where you can just take things out and change things around.
Yeah.
Than to really faithfully adapt the novel.
Yeah.
So, actually the movie version that I really liked, which had a mixed reaction, but I actually really liked this adaptation, was Hayao Miyazaki's adaptation of Diana Wynne Jones.
Now, I haven't seen that. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that. And now I'm blanking on...
The name of the book is Howl's Moving Castle.
Yes, Howl's Moving Castle, right.
Which, I love that book. It was one of my favorites growing up. I mean,
I have never been able to get into anime.
Oh!
I love animation. I have never... I've watched... Princess Mononoke, to me, was boring.
No!
Yeah.
Blasphemy!
I mean... You know what the biggest problem is? I can't get over the artwork.
But it was so beautiful in Princess Mononoke.
I don't care for the eyes. I don't care for that stuff, for the Astro Boy style of art. I don't like the fact that it's not full animation, that things only move like every umpteen frames, which I understand is a choice. It's not an economic thing. This is a style. But it's a style that doesn't speak
to me. Have you seen Spirited Away?
I saw part of it. I didn't. I'm going to try it again.
Okay, Spirited Away is one of those magical movies I have ever seen.
I'm not saying that I'm right, understand. I know.
Personal preference. I totally understand.
And it's not even necessarily.
For the audience here, Spirited Away, wonderful movie. It has one of the most amazing.
You know, I'm absolutely willing to believe that. I'm talking about a personal problem here. Is I don't understand anime. Now, here's the thing. I suspect that one of these days, Amy Goldschlager has given me a couple of titles. You can give me a couple of titles as well. One of these days, I will click in. I'm sure this is going to eventually happen. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to devour the stuff. There are some books, that wonderful books, occasionally, where I'll read the first 30 pages and it's like, no.
Then
Dahlgren by Samuel R. Delaney took me 3 tries. The third time, and that's an 800-page book.
Right.
And the third try, I zoomed through it and I read it twice in a row. Took me 3 months. That's a complex, deep book. Makes Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell look simple in comparison. It's a book that'll be studied in 200 years. It's a great novel. And it took me 3 tries to get past page 30.
Yes, you know.
You just, sometimes you have to click. Right. And if, you know, if there isn't a particular connection at a moment.
Yeah.
Then I don't always make it. And I've had a problem with a lot of anime, and some of it has to do with the style. It's just not. Now, I love animation. I'm a huge animation fan. I know more trivia about a lot of animation than most people. I took a course years ago taught at the New School by Leonard Maltin on animation. On animation. Actually, that was just Warner Brothers. I also took a course in Betty Boop.
Wow.
Because as I, and that's a whole other story I won't do this morning, she was my landlady. She was my parent. She owned the house my parents, I grew up in, Helen Kane. And well, now I have to play a Helen Kane song. But I love animation. And there's something about anime that to me, and of course what's going on is, the Japanese take the American style, turn it into their own. The Americans and take the Japanese style, and it goes back and forth. This is the same thing that Kurosawa did with Westerns.
The interesting thing
where
about
reverberates
so right, 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 right. The interesting thing about Japanese animation to me is that they have such a long visual history, and not just of, you know, art in kind of a more Western sense with paintings. I mean, they have this ukiyo-e and block prints and narrative wood block prints. I mean, in the Edo period of Japan, they would actually have things that are basically proto mangas.
Your icon online is
yes.
a lovely
block yeah, exactly.
Print.
Yeah. My icon online is a bijin from a ukiyo-e reading a scroll or something with Mount Fuji in the background.
Yeah, I never knew what that was.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
I can't remember who did it. It's a famous ukiyo-e artist though, and so it was, you know, so basically like they would have these and monstrous things. I mean, the most fascinating thing to me about old Japanese artwork is how well a graphically sexual it could be. I mean, you have never seen bigger dildos but It's truly remarkable. But also how
that's a good thing that I've never yes. seen bigger than
I mean, I remember I had a wonderful professor in college because I majored in East Asian languages and cultures with an emphasis on Japan. And he was also a Japanese studies person at Columbia. I didn't know that I was going to do Japan when I went to Columbia, but it turns out that it had one of the best programs in the country for East Asian studies, specifically Japan.
Ah.
It's kind of famous for it. And this professor is a really great professor of that. And he studied issues of homosexuality and the way that they perceived sexual orientation in Japan, which is actually very different from classical Japan, had a very different interpretation of it than we do in the modern sense. It was basically everything was very fluid. They had no clear sense of rigidity of preferring one over the other. It was considered kind of colors. And so sometimes you like male colors and sometimes you like female colors. And if you read the Tale of Genji, he is totally bisexual. I mean, he just sleeps with anybody, man or woman, and it's never anything.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's the ultimate playboy. So I think that the Japanese tradition has its own roots and has a lot of wonderful mythology, and that's the reason why Spirited Away to me is the most amazing.
But you see, you have a knowledge. You have an innate knowledge of the culture, mm-hmm. of what's going on. I don't. I'm
right.
illiterate in this. And so I'm coming to it from, in this case, an extremely Western
yeah.
point of view. No knowledge. And, you know, this is actually, I think, a legitimate criticism in terms of the form, is that somebody ought to be able to come in and completely pick up on it. I was able to watch last night a movie called Mongol, which is basically a Mongol telling. It's Russian, German, Kazakhstan movie of the telling of Genghis Khan.
Oh, right. I heard of that movie.
It was very good, the end. I mean, it wasn't that the end was bad. It's just that it has a problem so many big epic movies does, where it sort of loses its focus and all of a sudden becomes a CGI epic instead of this human drama. And light drama that was in.
Well, I don't think you have to understand history.
But I was
of this
able
stuff.
To get into that.
Right.
I totally.
I mean, plenty of anime fans have absolutely no knowledge of the stuff I'm talking about. I mean, this is stuff I learned after I got into it. I mean,
but you have the history of the culture.
Right. I mean, it makes it more, you can appreciate it more, especially Spirited Away, because Spirited Away is directly drawing on those traditions, in a much more overt way than I think the rest, a lot of other anime does.
But part of the problem with Spirited Away is it takes half an hour to get started, and I didn't make it through that half hour. Then later on, another time, I happened to catch 10 minutes of it, of the latter portion of the movie on TV, and I was entranced. I was so utterly focused on it, but it hadn't gotten there in the beginning, the whole business at the zoo and all that. It took a long time to get going.
I don't know.
So you went in with this expectation, knowing what was to come.
I saw Spirited Away in theaters within a week of it coming out. I honestly didn't know a thing about it when I went to see it. It's actually a thing. I think it's kind of a preference thing. People will talk about how to start novels, how to start stories. And tend to be the kind of person who was perfectly happy for a book to start slow, to start with characters, to set up atmosphere, as long as it's the writing. As long as something else is going on that can interest me.
Does. I mean, he does that beautifully. You're talking
about exactly. And I am totally...
And you do it well, too. We're going to have to talk about your books.
Okay. I'm perfectly happy to... I love getting immersed in the writer's world as long as I feel confident that they know what they're doing. And I guess it's also the same thing with Miyazaki. I suppose that I could see how that intro would be a little slow if you weren't, just along for the ride in the way that I was from the very beginning.
Mm. Yeah, well, and that may be my problem. It may be a mindset issue.
Yeah.
But you know, but there are things that where I go in scowling and I come out oh my God, that was amazing. And Miyazaki has not yet done it for me.
If anything will, it's going to be Spirited Away. That's all I'll
say.
Okay,
well, I'm going to try that again. I mean, my favorite animators in the world, John Lasseter, for example, they worship at the screens that show Miyazaki.
Yes.
You know, and John Lasseter is a great, he understands this stuff so well. How else could he make Pixar what it was if he didn't get it? You know, so I'm not saying, I'm not being critical of these things. There are things I will be critical about. Yeah. This is not one of them.
Good.
But let me tell the audience and you again, because this is my new favorite movie for a while. My favorite animated film at this moment is, I hope you can all see the T-shirt I'm wearing, Sita Sings the Blues. Okay, that's S-I-T-A Sings the Blues. How can you go see it? It's very simple. Go to SitaSingsBlues.com and enjoy it. It's freely available through Creative Commons. And it is shown occasionally on Channel 13. You can see it for free there. You can they've shown it at Symphony Space, and they've shown it at IFC. But this is a Creative Commons movie made single-handedly, pretty much, by a woman named Nina Paley. And it is an animated version of the Ramayana with music by Annette Henshaw, one of the great 1920s singers, you know, not quite as famous as Ruth Etting or Helen Kane, but up there when you listen to her stuff is all freely available on the internet at archive.org and various places. But Sita Sings the Blues, so you can download a DVD version of the movie, or you can watch it online on YouTube, including in high def. Just wonderful movie, wonderful movie. And I did not know what it was going in.
Well,
and it is a very different movie once it gets going than the opening. Different style of animation. There's three different. Well, some other time I'll go into this in great length. Maybe I can get Nina Paley on this show. But who? And I'd love to talk to her about the whole. Well, a lot of people have had her on the radio. Maybe I'll just be another ad. Anyway, so I wanted to, I needed to promote that movie because it's my new favorite film.
And sounds great.
And it's animated, and I love the animation. It's done in Flash.
Wow. Really?
The whole movie is done in Flash. Oh, no, some of it's hand-drawn.
Huh.
And fascinating, wonderful film, and incredibly entertaining. Anyway, you'd love it. And that's a funny thing, by the way. It has a cult following. It has a really strong following. And most people I know in the Skiffy circles, in the science fiction circles, I haven't met anybody else yet, except actually the proprietor of the Soho Gallery, John Ordover, who knows this movie.
Yeah. Well.
And yet, it's not that obscure if it's been on PBS, and or at least Channel 13.
That's true, yeah.
And IFC and Symphony Space, this is not what you call an obscure film. It's gotten those show screenings. Anyway, and it's the Ramayana, and it's 20s music. Ah, and it's anime, it's wonderful. Anyway, Racing the Dark, how is that done?
It's been interesting. It's... You know, it was my first novel. It's one of those things where you write a book, you publish it, and you're like, oh, God, whatever possessed me to do that? I don't know many writers who are super, super fans of their work after it's been published, especially their first novels. There's always things to, you know, you wish that you'd done better. I think that it did interesting things. It definitely did what I wanted it to do at the time. And I was like playing around with all these different ideas about like trying to write different kinds of cultures and different kinds of storytelling within kind of a still within the fantasy rubric. And, you know, its response has been very interesting to me. A lot of comments that kind of echo things I feel like I could have done better with the book, and a lot of things that I kind of wonder, like, you know, some people like love it and some people are just like, I don't understand this at all. And it's definitely been very interesting to me to see, because I think it's, you know, to me it's very genre. Mm-hmm. My publisher, but I think it's interesting that like my publisher it was his first genre book. He's otherwise basically does literary African American fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like my book just appealed to him, and that's why he decided to go for it. It's, you know, it's a great small press.
Well, it's still literary African American
right,
fiction,
exactly.
your book. It just happens to also be a fantasy.
And I think that's I think that there's just interesting things about kind of the way the genre tilts, and like the way that you can write something that's still, you know, I feel like is very much inside the genre in some ways, but it's also kind of on its edges. It's interesting for me to kind of see that, because I wasn't really aware of any of that when I was writing the book. I mean, I wrote the first draft in college. I mean, I was just basically, I just sat there and thought, like, you know what I wish I could read? A fantasy novel that just has nothing to do with these Western tropes. I mean, and I'm sure there's no way, I mean, as a product of that culture, it's very difficult for me to get completely away from it. I mean, I tried, but I feel like at least perhaps the attempt to get to do something different, to get away from that in a way, is...
I mean, one can only go so far, because your thinking is determined, as we know, through Noam Chomsky, you know, by the language in which you
right.
think.
Right. Of course. I actually was just reading something really interesting about how some languages, including one of the Australian Aboriginal languages, I think, has... they use cardinal directions to spatially orient themselves. So instead of saying, like, this pencil is to the right of the cup, they'll say the pencil is to the east of the cup. That means that every speaker of that language has perfect dead reckoning. In a closed, airless room, they can tell you which way north is. Now, to me, that sounds almost supernatural. I just don't understand. But apparently we actually have some way of being able to tell that if you train yourself to
birds
do it.
Bees do it.
Birds, right. I mean, but
they do. I mean, that's so how
just
they...
Just talking about languages. I mean, I imagine writing in a language where just the language itself requires you to know where north is. I mean, I can barely find my way north with, like, the sun in the sky in the middle of Manhattan.
I think you've just given yourself an assignment.
That's a wonderful premise. I think it would be too. I mean, I just love the idea of languages.
And this is what
changing.
Le Guin did when the word for world is forest. She said, okay, how do you deal with the society in which?
Right.
And then go with the title, The Word for World is Forest. That's all that exists. And from that, this fabulous novella came forth. And it's the same kind of thinking that you're talking about here. Is how to... That, and that's the wonderful thing about the genre.
Yes.
I'm not calling it science fiction, but it's the genre.
And I love that. I mean, you know, like, that's why I feel like speculative is the best kind of umbrella word for what we're talking about. Like, taking things and really exploring aspects that I think literary fiction is less interested in, although, you know, the lines are very blurred, and I will not say one way or the other about the whole thing, but, you know, looking at trying to extrapolate and explore, like, really different things and about human culture, about aliens, about whatever, you know, just but using the things that we know. I mean, you know, just talking about birds, there's some speculation that birds actually see, like, physically see the magnetic pole lines. I mean, they just see it. Like, I try to imagine what your eyesight would look like if you just, everywhere you went, you just saw lines for where the magnetic north was.
And my suspicion is that it's, do they see it? Well, there's another sense involved.
Right.
You know, how do you describe smelling?
But in their case, I think they actually have, like, cones or rods in their eyes to detect that. I mean, it's literally, whatever it is.
There's a sensor, yeah.
It's spatially there. Like, whatever. And, you know, it's impossible. It's like, you know, the age-old philosophical question, does green to me look the same as green to you?
Right.
You know, I mean, there's things like that. I mean, and that... The interesting thing is, like, to some extent, fiction is all about just, like, assuming that we share things, because everything kind of breaks down out past a certain point of that. And I like the idea of trying to play around with that. On the other hand, I don't think that I can get to be experimental enough to really completely break down, like, all notions of common perception. I think...
Oh, you've got a long career ahead of you.
Right, you know? Who knows what I'll be doing when I'm 50? Exactly. So, I do like the idea of being experimental. I'm not the kind of writer who likes to write the same thing. To the point, I think, where at this point where I've written, I've published, I think, I don't know, 10 short stories, 10 or 11 short stories, and I've, you know,
and
written
three novels,
and, you know, and I'm writing.
You're an old hand now.
Yeah, but it's like at this point I realize that I don't...
You're quite accomplished, actually, when you think about
it. I don't know if I feel like that all the time. I always am trying, you know, but... Like,
well,
I just,
from this year, okay.
But I feel like...
And well accomplished, you know, the quantity and quality.
But writing is... it's always hard, but I always want it to do something kind of different. So I look at my, the work body of my short stories, and I'm like, my gosh, these have nothing in common with each other. I mean, it's, I feel it's one of those things where I feel when my sister reads my fiction, she says, oh, I know, that's Aliyah. That's Aliyah. Like, she knows, like, all of the kind of common bits. But if you just look at the descriptions of those stories, I'm like, what was I? You know, it almost is enough to make me wish that I could... You know, because some writers I love, just take one thing and basically, like, their whole lives are about, like, reworking it and getting deeper and deeper into it. I mean, Ellen Kushner, I adore. Mm-hmm. And she's basic. I mean, she hasn't done everything in Riverside at all, but she's, her stories with, first starting with Swords Point, and now she's written many stories about, like, her.
The latest being The Man with the Knives.
Right. The Man with the Knives, which I've read, is wonderful. It's a novella that she put out, starring. It's kind of, it takes place after Privilege of the Sword, if you are into Ellen Kushner, and it's heartbreaking. I cried and cried. So, I mean, but I think that's really interesting what she does. I just think
Henry Wessels just sent me an autographed copy of the book. It was wonderful. I had them on the show 2 months ago.
That edition is gorgeous. I mean, the whole thing. Oh my gosh, I just love
the Charles Vess artwork. Yeah.
Or Tom Canty.
I'm sorry, Tom Canty artwork. Yeah. Why am I thinking Charles Vess? Because there was a different book of hers. It was a Datlow book with Charles Vess. Okay, all these Ellens.
All these Ellens, right. It's true. Exactly. The field is replete with Ellens.
Well, all in New York anyway.
Right.
Or among the women who get to boss me around, you know, because I allow them to. You know, Kushner comes on the show and she says, Okay. No, Jim, this is your show. Now play this song. Now play that song. Now, she's another NPR hand. You know,
right, of course.
You know, she's so wonderful on the radio. I'm just happy to let her. and she came in. I don't think she realized how much she wanted to host. I have to have her back just so she can host.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure she'd be great.
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
No question. It's a question of, you know, her being able to wake up that early. Well, she can't always do it. She's a busy woman.
Right.
And have to coordinate her schedule, Delia's schedule, et cetera, et cetera. Right. She will be reading at NearSip this year, of course. She's sort of our regular December act now, she and Delia.
That's great.
Well, I've always thought that we should have like a family show in December, because, you know, everybody always hauls out their families, right?
Right, right.
So and I like to have something involving a little bit of music or something like that. So, you know, the Delia and Ellen show works for me. It's family. Yep.
Totally.
Why not? I better get them to say yes before I keep mentioning this. But actually, I sort of told Ellen, and she said, the fact is that with different curators, they've ended up doing 3 out of the last 4 years in December.
Wow.
The same month. You know, Claire Wolfe chose them last May. I should have Claire choose them again. Ooh, it's 6 o'clock, by the way.
Wow.
And this is WBAI, New York City. And we haven't even named your novels, damn it.
Oof.
Racing the Dark.
Racing the Dark. The sequel is The Burning City, which just came out.
Yes.
Long awaited by some.
Yes. I haven't read that yet. I haven't gotten it yet, but I have to find out who your publicist is. There was this guy I saw at your party, and I think he's your publicist. I see the last time he said, no, it's my boyfriend. It's like, oops, okay.
Yeah.
Is he your publicist as well?
No, I guess not.
So I have to find out who to.
Just special someone.
Yes, very good. And he's very nice, you know. Yeah. I thought, well, what? Yeah. And I ran into him at BEA also.
Right. He's an agent.
That's
why.
Ah.
That's not my agent. He's an agent.
Okay, yes. But you see, I somehow, again, with my usual keen perception, just conflated everything and got it wrong.
Right.
Anyway. Who does the agent for? Well, I'll ask off the air. Anyway, at any rate.
The book is Moonshine, which also just came out. I had 2 books come out in a month. It's entirely unrelated. 1920s. Lower East Side, New York, social activist with vampires novel.
And flappers.
And flappers. It's
absolutely. Charleston and flappers. And what a wonderful party that was.
Thank you.
The launch party for that book was just a memorable. I've got photos of it up on my Picasa. So if people go to ourwolf.com and click on where it says pics, you'll see. I may even have up there. I may still have the banana dance up there.
Oh, there are some amazing. That party was one of my great accomplishments. I'm this kind of crazy person who every time I come up with an idea for a novel, the first thing I think of, at least if I'm in the middle of the book, is I wonder what kind of party I could have for this. I just kind of like throwing parties, I think. And
well, you threw a good one there.
Yeah, I had a party in a art gallery in Chelsea with was a 1920s themed party with 1920s drinks. Everybody got up dressed in their best duds. We danced to the Dixieland jazz band that I brought in for the party while drinking our Mary Pickfords.
Yes.
And Fritz 75s. I wanted to have sidecars, but frankly, Cointreau was a little too expensive to cater to the entire party.
Although there's a way you can fix up a sidecar. You know, they're cheaper orange liqueurs.
Right, like it's a triple sec. And,
yeah, exactly.
Right, I mean,
exactly.
I could have done it, but like even
but
that, I was like,
Cointreau,
you know,
so
can't
good,
we
though.
Just have like a good sidecar? I'd rather just have a good sidecar. So maybe next time, if my book does very well, I have lots of money to toss around, I can have a great sidecar moon or sequel party. But
yes, absolutely.
For now, that I mean, you know, I feel like I.
I had a wonderful. I had to leave at 10 because it was a Friday night, and I had to go and do a show. And,
right.
But we got Adler to go. You know, that was right. Like, we got Margot to show up at that party. And
It was a great
event. If you
want
to see
event.
Margot in the background, you can see the book trailer.
Yes, I made a book trailer that I recorded at the party. The video is from the party, and then there's kind of voiceovers.
I recorded some of the music, but it
right.
was just too
yeah, it, echoey. It was too echoey. So basically, the band I got for the party was kind enough to let me use a recording of one of their songs, Just a Closer Walk with Thee, which is an old traditional song, so... did not, you know, that's public domain, but they, it was really fun. It's like a kind of, it's a short 30-second thing that I wrote a script for, and a friend of mine who's also in my writing group, Eugene Myers, did a wonderful job putting together this trailer.
Oh, he put that together?
Yes,
okay,
yes,
I didn't realize.
He did the whole thing. It was kind generousness of his heart.
I'm going to have to ask him. I've been filming the readings,
mm-hmm.
and I, of course, record all the readings.
Right.
But I'm trying to marry the film that I do on my little mm-hmm. HD camera with the audio that I record.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, at the end of an hour, in fact, at the end of 10 minutes, there's like, you know, a full half second difference.
Huh.
So it's out of sync.
Oh.
Right. You know, and you know, let me tell you, a half second is a long
oh, right.
time. So I have to figure out how to,
yeah,
you know, synchronize this exactly. And anybody who noticed that I go to the readings now, I actually clap my hands at the start of the reading. It's not because I'm trying to get people's attention. It's a clapper. I'm synchronizing the beginning of the film with the beginning of the audio. And then at the end of the reading, I tried to get one distinctive sound on there so I can synchronize the end and then see if I can marry the two of them using the software
mm-hmm.
that I've got. But maybe Eugene can help.
I'm sure he could.
Yeah. Okay, so we've now actually at least named the three novels. And
yes.
By the concept, by the way, of moonshine is so clever because moonshine, the prohibition concept of moonshine, the vampire
right,
concept.
Right, right.
And, and it's a fun book.
It was a lot of fun to write. It was one of those sometimes actually just – a little side note. I have a bad habit. Writing habit. I write novels to play hooky for writing other novels. Moonshine
okay.
is the procrastination novel for The Burning City. And, like, the entire book was the procrastination. and I just finished.
Did it come quicker? Was it?
Yeah, it was a very fast thing for me to write. I mean, I just came up with the idea. And
it's
it was
a very fast thing to
it
read.
Just
it's
gripped
good
me.
Read.
I mean, I was just so. I loved my main character, Zephyr. She was just. She's an interesting character, and it was just something about her voice was just, like, it just flowed, and I really liked her friends, and basically every time I would get in there, I'd just feel, like, really happy, because I thought, like, you know, it was just kind of enjoyable for me to get back into the world and all of that stuff, so that was fun, and then, you know, so then I wrote Racing the Dark, or, sorry, I wrote The Burning City, and then, you know, this Moonshine is a two-book deal, so I'm writing right now, deep in the middle of writing the sequel to Moonshine, which is yet untitled, and, I just...
Ooh,
you know,
another party.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew this was going to happen. I tried to stop myself, but I just couldn't. I wrote an entirely different book. Like, I have right now completed a completely unrelated young adult science fiction novel.
Science fiction?
Yes. Science fiction set 400 years in the future on the coast of Brazil in Bahia. Ooh. But you kind of post, it's post the nation state of Brazil, but it's in what is Bahia now.
Yeah, by the way, if you ever find an orange liqueur, you want a great orange liqueur, uh-huh. One called Bahia, it's very hard to find.
Really?
Very hard. When I was a bartender in the Rainbow Grill in the 70s, it was a very popular thing. I don't think they export it anymore, but it is still made.
So is it Brazilian?
Yes. Oh. With a name like that, yeah.
Of course, right? Oh my gosh. That's great. I want to find that. That's a big quantum with Bahia. I can marry my two books. But so I just have this like this very bad hooky habit. So I am now back on the wagon. If my editor is listening to this, don't even worry. But you know, like, so my hooky habit is kind of it's interesting because it makes the writing of the book that I'm playing hooky with mm-hmm. even more urgent because I know that there's something else I need to be doing, so I'm writing it like as fast as I can, and it's kind of this headlong thing, which is I think kind of fun. It's mm-hmm. it's just an interesting way of doing it.
I think so, and I think that it's good for us on the other side of the reading equation, because here's some, it's taken you there, and
right.
You're taking us there, so it's a great trip.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I hope. I hope, you know, the thing is, all my books have a kind of distinct sensibility, and mm-hmm. I'm not really sure, like, what that is exactly, but I do know that, like, there's a whole, you know, I'm the kind of, and I think this is probably a good thing, but I tend to write characters, like, distinctly enough that people are like, I hate her, I like her. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, not to, you know, like, some characters can be very much like a cipher, mm-hmm. you know, the kind of like the stand-in character for the reader. This is
no, your characters
the genre
are very
is like
real.
A Mary Sue.
Yeah,
you know, and it's I'm not whatever else I do, and I'm not in any way.
Well, here's the scary question. I probably shouldn't. We need to take a break, and then also you're going
right,
to
right.
read.
Yes,
but here's the question:
mm-hmm.
casting.
Casting?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, yeah, I knew
no,
that
no,
would.
No, no, no.
The trouble, the furrowed brow I caused on this woman. I should be ashamed.
I can't at all. No, great, because here's the thing. I don't watch enough television to know enough actors. So every time I think about things like that, I'm like, wouldn't it be great if it
oh,
were
see, I was a receptionist
a mini,
at talent agency.
Oh,
so
yeah. Wouldn't
I
it be great
business.
If it were a mini-series with total unknowns? Mm-hmm. Like, that to me sounds like it'd be a lot of fun. I mean, there's...
Because your characters are so real that, you know, and again, this is the question I asked Susanna Clarke. And mm-hmm. we had a lot of fun casting...
I don't know, you know, especially, I honestly, I cannot tell you, like, this question has just, like, made my brain implode. No, I don't know what to do. The other thing is that there's, you know, the main character of the book is Zephyr, and she kind of has this strange, questionable love interest in Amir, who mm-hmm. is Arabic. And
yeah. You see, that's one of the problems is that your characters,
Arabic
there
actors.
Aren't enough actors.
I don't
out
know
there
of them
anyway.
I'm sure they exist, of course, but like they don't. They're not. You know, the way unfortunately our culture is, they're not going to be major superstars. So it's
and there are sadly few and far between
right.
at this time.
At this
hopefully
time,
that
right?
Change,
yeah, hopefully.
But, yeah.
But that kind of creates. So I don't know. Basically,
yeah.
Like, in terms of the casting, I'm like, why don't we just find people who are really great and you've never seen them before?
There you go. Or animate.
Animation would be great.
Yeah.
I'd love that.
That would work for Moonshine real nice.
Yeah.
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 It would
be. I think it would be very fun.
Yeah. So let's take a break.
Okay.
Now you know what song I'm going to play.
Woohoo!
Yeah, okay. So this is what I, in my mind, determined was the soundtrack.
Very rightly. Shine.
And I'm glad to have introduced it to Aliyah. So this is Hour of the Wolf. My guest this morning, Aliyah Dawn Johnson, spelt like and rhymes with papaya.
Yep.
Aliyah, although, again, I was mentioning I saw a TV show. I have to ask Barbara. We saw a show in which I was in care. I think, yeah, it was Doctor Who. An episode that is, I think, currently will be on tonight on BBC America. I think the second part of it, the Hollow Earth episode, and with the Silurians. And, yes, that's where it is. And there's a chief character, bad guy, but not really a bad guy from her light. Named Aliyah, and I said, well, it can't be the same name, but watching the credits, it is. So somebody needs to inform them how to pronounce your name. So take that, Stephen Moffat. And oh God, that'll start a whole thing, Tempest and Stephen Moffat. I'm not going there. Okay, so we'll be back in a couple of minutes. This is the great, wonderful Marian Harris. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and webcasting over WBAI.org and archived at archive.wbai.org. All that good stuff. The program is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. But as coined by Robert Anton Heinlein in 1947, speculative fiction. A lot of people forget Heinlein coined that term, which makes them want to stop using the term. And my name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, Aliyah Dawn Johnson, whose latest novel, penultimately latest novel. Yeah. Here we're going to be reading from Moonshine.
Yep.
Instead of The Burning City.
Yes.
Why don't you talk it up? If it needs any talk up, because you're starting from the beginning of the book, right?
I'm starting from chapter one. I'll read a chunk from chapter one.
It's a tightly defined, whatever
I feel like reading. I think it's kind of self-explanatory. It's like I said, Lower East Side. It's an alternate New York. So for those who read vampire fiction, you know, there's kind of two different broad categories. There's the ones where the vampires are secret and the ones where the vampires are out in the open and just part of society. And this is the latter kind. So I would not consider this a work of alternate history. I did nothing at all to try to imagine what history would be like if vampires had come out at this time and how things. No, I did not do that. That was not really my project. I honestly wanted to like explore metaphors more. And so it's basically the 20s that you know or you would know. I'm not an expert in the period, and so I apologize for any infelicities that you might catch. But it is basically the New York 20s. The mayor is Jimmy Walker. The mayor was Jimmy Walker. You know, she's in the Lower East Side on, she lives on Ludlow Street. Mm. You know, this is all New York. And so it's called Moonshine, and here is chapter one. I skidded on a patch of ice as I rounded the corner onto Lafayette Street, only years of experience saving me as I tottered in the bare 12 inches between a shuttered, horse-drawn hansom cab and a Model T. The white-gloved matron behind the wheel had clearly come to regard her motor vehicle the way one might a pet cat that always vanished at the full moon, and the sight of my bicycle sliding gracefully past broke her remaining self-control. I can't imagine what she found so terrifying about me, unless it was the grin I couldn't keep from my face as I dared the January ice. Daddy always did say I was too reckless in winter. The matron shrieked and discovered the purpose of a curious little button in the middle of her steering wheel. Her car swerved, thankfully away from the horses, which were even now whinnying and snorting in agitation. I made it past the hansom and auto moments before one of the horses reared and whacked the Model T's gleaming rear fender. I winced. 2 more seconds, and that would have been my stomach. Damn Tammany Hall, I fumed, like it would kill those bastards to do something useful like fixing roads in between winning elections. Tonight, of course, the criminally narrow streets were relatively clear. No one respectable wanted to be out after sundown on a new moon. I checked my watch, 7:45, and pedaled faster. It wouldn't do for the teacher to be tardy to her own class, especially not this class, and especially not tonight. That's when I saw it, of course, just a huddled shadow on an unspeakably dirty street that hundreds of people had probably passed by today without comment. I sailed past it, too, before something made me dig my heels into the ground and turn around to ride back. It wasn't as though the back of my neck prickled or I felt a telltale shiver crawl up my skin. I can't do anything like that, no matter what my students might whisper about me. But I do have a knack for noticing. It's a skill my daddy cultivated, since I can't shoot fish in a barrel and he needed his eldest to be good at something. I had to kick the spokes to turn the handlebar hard right and then jigger them back out again so I could straighten the wheel. I crashed over the drainage ditch and slid on the worn soles of my boots over the sidewalk. I was deep in the shadow of a monolithic, grimy factory, the kind that put me in mind of hollow-eyed immigrant children locked in rooms by unscrupulous overseers so they won't escape. They hired vampire guards in those kind of hellholes. I shuddered and looked, suddenly, back at the street. Deserted. I think the hair on the back of my neck would have risen then if it weren't already smothered by the respectable starch of my shirt collar. I walked closer to the crawl space, too small to even be an alley, between the tenement and a former munitions warehouse. A rat, startled by my approach, scrambled over a gray heap that was barely distinguishable from the other refuse and shot into the gutter by my bicycle. My eyes adjusted to the gloom. I could finally see the faint outline of the innocuous little hump that had so firmly caught my attention. It was covered in a child-sized peacoat that smelled of damp wool. Shaking, because, by God, there is no way to get used to this, no matter how long I've lived in the city, I pulled back the cloth. I saw a boy, with hair much redder than my own ochre-tinged brown. His skin was so pale beneath a shock of freckles that I knew what had happened even before I spotted the telltale punctures on his neck. I sat back on my heels and clenched my teeth. His neck held 7 separate wounds, shallow and rough, as if they'd been teasing him. I'd bet that if I pulled down the collared shirt and suit jacket, finely made but worn, I'd see more along his back and arms. It looked like some sort of hazing ritual and maybe a bit of revenge. It looked like the Turn Boys and was just one more reason for me to despise them. The young vampire gang ran roughshod over their chosen kingdom of Little Italy and the greater Lower East Side. This poor kid was rather far down Lafayette for their activities, but I didn't doubt for a minute who had done this. I'd seen enough of their work to know. A solitary car sped behind me on the road, sending a spray of icy mud over my bicycle and splashing onto my blue tweed skirt. I glanced at my watch. 8:10. Damn. I had just enough time to speed down to the police station, report the body, and get to class. But I also knew what the police would do when they got him. They didn't take any chances, especially not with the anonymous immigrant children. Too many kids went missing to waste the precious time hunting in one of the hundreds of Lower Manhattan tenements for a distraught mother who probably didn't speak any English. So they took them to the morgues, turned up the electric lights, and staked them. Sometimes they cut off their heads for good measure, if turning looked likely. This boy wouldn't keep his head. He reminded me a bit of my little brother Harry back in Montana, the same freckles and shock of red hair. He wore one forlorn blue mitten, the other must have fallen off in the struggle. Zephyr, I told myself sternly, attempting to speak some sense to my paralyzed brain, Harry still laughs about putting a beehive in your knickers. It ain't him. At which good, rousing inducement to sanity, I discovered myself scooping the pathetically light body from the ground and toting it back to my bicycle. I always knew the situation was serious when I resorted to country grammar. I didn't know what I was doing. I swear I almost never do. I operate on nothing but horrible instincts and a dash of self-preservation. I draped the boy around my shoulders, wrestled the handlebars straight, and started back down the street. I could leave him in the school building. It ought to be safe. I huffed and pedaled faster, sweating now with the exertion. The boy wasn't heavy, but I'd never been that strong, and I'd just come back from a crisis across the bridge in Brooklyn. A Russian immigrant with a husband and kids, turned a week ago, had apparently missed the warning about alcohol. Or maybe she'd heard it and dismissed it along with the rest of the Temperance Union's hand-wringing hogwash. I might have had little personal experience with demon alcohol, but there was no comparison between what it did to my little sister when she found her way into Daddy's stash and what it did to others unfortunate or reckless enough to imbibe. A fit of the giggles and a morning headache was nothing compared to... well, that. The Russian vampire's skin had turned red, they told me. Not just flushed, like your average speakeasy drunk. Oh no, blood red. It started to bead on her skin like sweat. It dribbled from her mouth. Her children were terrified, of course. No one had told them what had happened to their mother, only that she was sick. A week's legally acquired blood puddled onto the floor, burning through the wood with its foul-smelling venom. The oldest child and the father ran away. The youngest must have frozen, with shock, fear, disbelief, God only knows, because he stayed behind. The father didn't realize until it was too late. The mother, blood-starved, drunk, newly turned, and not a little crazed, turned upon her child and fed. She realized what she had done when she was sated. Too late. Troy Kavanaugh's pack of defenders got to her first. He told me the woman begged them to stake her. They obliged, along with the boy. Kids are too dangerous to let turn, or so defenders like Troy claim. I know him from way back, even before New York. He'd met my daddy for some big, legendary Yeti hunt up in North Montana, and when I came down here, I worked for his group for a while. I may not be much of a shot, but you can't be the oldest daughter of the best demon hunter in Montana without learning a few tricks. I pulled my weight, but I had to leave. The others might not be human, but they're still people, you know? Troy never seemed to get that. He called me in during the cleanup to deal with the new widower and his son. Sid had called for a delicate hand. Troy thinks a strong jaw makes up for a lousy personality. So I'd been on my bicycle all day, and my tailbone felt like someone had been smashing it with a mallet, and I had a dead boy, the kind you're never supposed to let turn if you're an ignorant other phobe like Troy, who could double as a vampire pincushion draped across my neck, and damn if I wasn't getting some odd looks as I huffed my way through the busy Canal Street intersection. Why did things like this always happen to me? I had to laugh, and saw my breath float away in the glare of the electric lamps, because I'm certifiable. 8:02, I shot past the snarl of traffic on Bowery and stopped at the corner of Rivington and Christie. Sweat dripped down my neck and made my shirt cling to my back. My buttocks were still quite wet. My toes seemed to have lost all feeling. I leaned, trembling, over the handlebars and panted. Behind me rose the ragged edifice of Christie Elementary, smog-encrusted and sporadically heated. Only 3 of its classrooms are equipped with electric lighting, and even that is about as reliable as a succubus in heat. An immigrant school, with quite a few others no less, was not a high priority for our delightful city government. The boy on my neck started to groan. Not a normal groan, you know, made of air and vocal cords and wholesome biology. A distinctly otherworldly one that should have been impossible for such a small child to make. It was too loud, for one thing, like a ship's foghorn in my ears. Aside from his mouth, his body lay perfectly still. No air entered and exited his chest. I shuddered. "Vampires are people," I said quietly, to steady myself. I had not been present at many awakenings, but I knew enough to realize that I had very little time to put the boy safely away. He looked barely 11 years old. He'd be wilder than most. I struggled off the bicycle just as the boy began to stir in earnest. The motion put me off balance, and I found myself sprawling on the ice underneath the school's shadow, grappling with a weakly flopping vampire. "Oh, bloody Christ," I muttered. "Okay, one thing at a time. Get up, Zephyr. You have class in a minute." Grimacing, I planted my right foot on a patch of sidewalk that looked miraculously ice-free and wobbled into a crouch. I started to hum a lullaby my mama liked to sing when I was growing up. Maybe it worked on little vampires, too? But the boy was getting stronger, his groan turning into a kind of strangled roar. The few people left on the streets in this shaded, ill-lit area hurried past me, their eyes firmly fixed on the sidewalk. "I could be dying, you know," I shouted after them. "Right, bloody heartless city." Gripping the squirming boy with my left hand, I pulled my bicycle out of the gutter with my right and hauled them both to the school steps. "Having some trouble, Miss Hollis?" I froze momentarily, white-knuckled on the handlebars. I knew that voice, and I can't say I was entirely pleased to hear it. I turned to face him with a smile I suspected was more than a little harried. He was leaning on the stone railing halfway up the steps, his arms crossed nonchalantly. Amir, he had called himself when he first appeared in my class last week. No last name, or at least none he would give me. He reminded me of Rudolph Valentino in The Sheik. Foreign, handsome, dangerous, but darker. His features broader and a little more attractive. His English was impeccable, if oddly accented. Except after class, when I questioned what possible use he had for a course in basic literacy and elocution. Then he'd given me a pitch-perfect impression of a Russian immigrant 2 months off the boat. "That boy's freshly turned," he said, nodding at the child, but not moving. I grit my teeth. "I am aware of that, Amir. The situation is under control, then." At that precise, cosmically aligned moment, the boy gave a bone-shuddering snarl and latched his prepubescent fangs into the now quite wilted collar of my shirt. "You can't bleed a shirt, you idiotic—" I was forced to cut off my tirade, but for the boy, with a speed I could hardly credit, had wrapped his legs around my torso and forced me to fall. Amir reached me a second later and attempted to remove the boy, who clung to me like an otherworldly leech. "What time is it?" I shouted over the mewling growls as the boy made as he fumbled for the location of my actual neck. Ah, the untold benefits of conservative shirts. Amir paused. He looked quite nonplussed, which, despite the exacerbating circumstances, pleased me inordinately. "Are you serious?" he said. I swatted the boy's mittened hand away when it wandered over my breast and pressed my back up against the stone railing. "Perfectly." He had managed to grip one of the boy's arms and so had to reach awkwardly with his left hand to pull out a pocket watch I imagine would not have looked out of place on President Coolidge himself. "A minute past 8, he said. "Shall we tell the blood-crazed vampire that you're late? Maybe he'll be polite enough to resume his mauling after you've finished." I glowered at him, but was prevented from coming up with an appropriately dry retort by the sensation of gums and fast-sharpening teeth rasping across my suddenly exposed throat. I cursed and struggled away from his mouth. Amir now had him gripped by the waist and was slowly prying him off me. "Did he bite you?" Amir gasped. To my distant amusement, he seemed quite concerned. "Vampire gums are not known to be fatal." "Oh, should I just let him go, then, since you find this so easy?" "I am perfectly capable of dealing with this myself, Amir," I heard myself saying, despite the copious evidence to the contrary. With an odd, dangerous smile, Amir lowered his brush-thick eyelashes and let the boy go. With a noise like a cat strangling to death on a hairball, the boy launched himself at my neck. The fangs, dull as they were good enough to break my skin at a direct attack. I shrieked, still more out of annoyance than fear, and reached deep into my pocket for my switchblade. Pure blessed silver, that blade, a gift from Daddy before I left home. I'd never used it after I left Troy. I'd almost forgotten it was there. With a practice movement, I lay the dull edge of the blade against the exposed, pallid flesh of his collarbone. He flinched away from the burning touch of blessed metal. The hesitation was enough to allow Amir to yank him off of me fully. For a moment, I had the absurdly funny view of a little vampire struggling like an upturned cockroach. I stood up. Only a little blood had escaped the tiny puncture wounds on my neck, but I wiped it away carefully and adjusted my wilting collar. "It bit you?" Amir asked, his voice quiet. The vampire's noises were gentler in Amir's grip. Apparently, it did not regard him as quite so tasty a meal. I shrugged. "Barely a scratch," I said. Still, my heart was racing. Even less can turn a person. My, how serious he sounded. It made me smile. "Oh, don't worry about me. What time is it?" Warily, he reached for his watch, hanging freely from his waistcoat. 3 minutes passed. I cursed and picked up my bicycle. "I must go. Would you... Please, there's a room in the basement I think will hold him. Could you take care of him for me, just until I'm done? I wouldn't normally ask this, but..." He smiled, but it didn't quite reach those dark eyes. "You're late." "Go ahead. I'll just have to miss dear Mr. Hamilton tonight." I barely registered his gently mocking tone as I was already up the stairs and opening the door to the school. I knew the Federalist Papers wasn't the most popular choice as a learning text, but I've always felt the recent immigrants to this country should at least be aware of the ideals of its founding, even when they did not live up to the reality. "Thank you," I said to him, awkwardly, from where he still stood on the steps. The vampire seemed to hardly trouble him at all now. Not for the first time, I wondered what precisely Amir was. Surely not human. "Zephyr," he said, just before I shut the door behind me, "how do you know you won't turn?" His voice was so strange and devoid of mockery that I paused and, to my surprise, answered him. "Why, because I can't turn, of course. I'm immune. Is that normal for humans?" I shrugged. I've never met anyone else with it, and I'd long ago given up asking my parents how it had happened. "Oh," was all he said. Since moving to the city, I'd managed to keep that peculiarity of mine from everyone except my roommate. I would have wondered why I'd so blithely revealed it to Amir if I weren't already so late. And that's it.
And that was From Moonshine, read for you by the author, Alia Dawn Johnson. This, well, it's the Duke. We'll be right back. Duke Ellington. Oh, the mooch. I mean, come on. It's Ellington. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. I mean, love doesn't begin to... I mean, it's just... It transcends that. There's, you know, it's...
Yeah, it's great.
Like loving air, you know. It's Ellington. Oh, the mooch. Here, and speaking of mooch, this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial radio at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. And Hour of the Wolf is the program. And the guest, as Ken said, hello, guest, come on, Ken, is Alaya Dawn Johnson. We should spell A-L-A-Y-A, as in young adult, which sort of helps. I'm sorry, it just... but that is sort of a YA novel, would you say? You've written YA, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I
you didn't
at
write
the moment
it to be
I am
that.
Interested in coming of age stories. So right. A lot of things I write kind of end up being in that vein. And Moonshine is like, it's kind of like a coming of age in your 20s novel. I mean, it's about a girl who comes to New York to reinvent herself, basically. Right. I mean, her dad is, as you heard when I just read it, her dad is a demon hunter, and she's decided to become an activist for vampire rights.
Right.
So, you know, she's like many people, she came to New York and was like, I want to be a different person. And so that's kind of her tale.
And there's also a coming of age, obviously, in Racing the Dark.
Oh, yeah. No, Racing the Dark is...
I mean, that's what it is.
Racing the Dark is a coming of age story. I mean, it starts out when she's 13, and when she gets her period is the first scene of the book, and then it ends when she's about 19.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next book continues on. It's funny,
book entitled...
The Burning City.
Which is published
June 15th. And it has... Basically... It's funny, Racing the Dark takes place over about 6 years, and The Burning City takes place in about 3 months.
Mm.
And the final book in the trilogy will be, I believe it is 11 days.
Ooh, okay.
So it each one kind of gets success. Like the time scales crunch and crunch.
That's interesting. Yeah. And but that also says something about the process involved in the person's life and thinking.
Right. I mean, the
span.
Yeah, basically, you know, the things that happened to her in the first book are over a very, they're the final, it's a kind of the end game of something that's been planned and plotted for many, many, many years, even before that book started. And, like, The Burning City is where you would start to discover why Lana, my main character, has become embroiled in this fight with the spirits, and
mm-hmm.
And why her mentor now kind of antagonist.
I'm looking forward to it. I didn't know this. It's 3 years. You claim it's 3 years, and a half years, which means it's been about 3 years since I read Racing the Dark. It doesn't seem that long. At all.
Yeah, no, it doesn't seem like that to me either. I was like, how did that happen?
No. Something else has happened
yes,
here.
Yes, yes. Disruption of the space-time continuum.
Time. Yeah. Exactly. Do you want to try this?
Yes,
okay.
Sure.
If you would like to call up and speak with Alaya Dawn Johnson, you are hereby invited to do so, as long as you are relevant, at 212-209-2900. Is the phone. I almost said 2950 after X many weeks of begging on the air for money. No, we're back to the phone number. We've reclaimed the station. 212-209-2900. I wasn't even expecting to pitch last week, and then I found out that Delphine was here, and it's like, oh, sorry, Rick. My guess was Rick Bose. Sorry, Rick, I'm going to pitch. And I did. Well, what do you know? Ooh, look at all these calls. Good morning, WBAI. You're on the air.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Alaya.
Hi.
James, for you, I'm sending you an email. You might find this interesting because I know you like Hour of the Wolf because it's your show title, and I found some very interesting literary allusions to the phrase in, of all places, a 17th century Neapolitan fairy tale collection.
Oh, very cool.
And
do they go from the Swedish tradition?
Yes, they go from a lot of traditions. But I'll send
the Varg Demon.
Yes. I'll send you all the information in an email. Alaya, you're very zestful, and it's very hard to contain.
Well,
you're zest and verve.
And who would want to contain?
No, you wouldn't want to. May I ask you, what is the derivation of the name Alaya? It's very beautiful.
Sure. Basically, my parents are not quite hippies. They're the proto-hippies, and it's a Buddhist state of enlightenment. called Alaya. So that's what they named me after.
Have you read much Buddhist literature?
No. No, I mean, they're not Buddhist. It was kind of...
No, yeah. I understand that. But you did say you were you read a lot of East Asian.
Yeah, and, no, I have, actually, so now that you pointed that out.
And you know, by the way, you mentioned Japanese tradition. You know, by the way, that even the simplest folktales in Japan are very graphic sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
They have creatures that like to do strange things, like kappas and tenuki
and kitsune. Oh, the Japanese tradition of fantastic and their creatures, it's just, it's so deep and
they
rich.
Like to bite, they like to bite people in certain places. We won't mention on the air.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of big books.
They'd like to bite them on the air, yes.
Yeah. Other places, too. Anyway, you mentioned some big books, and you mentioned some of my favorites. The Tale of Genji, I could not put that down.
That book is great.
I couldn't put it down. Well over 1,000 pages. You mentioned Jonathan Strange, another favorite. Mists of Avalon, I have to throw in there, even after all these years.
You know that I kind of love that book.
You're gonna, you're gonna call that a guilty pleasure.
It is a bit of a guilty pleasure, but I read that book. I've read that book about two or three times. Again, I don't think I've read it since college, but I remember being really impressed with it when I was younger. I think there's something about the fact that it was just all about these women, and it was the tale of King Arthur with these strong women. You might tell just from what I've mentioned of my literature here, I really like stories about women and their relationships.
We'll have to talk about strong women sometime, but in folk literature. Anyway.
Yeah, I would just dissent here saying I love stories with strong women. I love Arthurian literature. I just didn't get the impression that Marion Zimmer Bradley loved Arthurian literature.
Well, I have to tell you, James, and I won't go into this, but she was on the first tour of Magical Britain that I was on. She was the hostess.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe being up close to her changed a few things. Anyway, a couple of other titles you mentioned in terms of big books. You mentioned Jonathan Strange, Mr. Avalon.
Strange and Mr. Norrell. We should give the proper
Norrell.
Title.
Yes, I know.
Oh, well, I'm telling the listeners,
you. Three books, Elia, that I have to mention outside the Skiffy tradition, but this is for professional reasons because of my specialization and what it is.
And you should tell people what it is. You're a CUNY professor in...
Western fiction and history, frontier fiction. Centennial, and I'm not a Michener fan. I mean, Michener, I think, you know...
Huh.
Well, Centennial was different in a lot of areas. The other two books that are my favorites in terms of big books were Lonesome Dove by McMurtry, and I met him many years ago in a very odd fashion, and... They're not big in terms of pages, but the sweep is big. Thomas Berger's Little Big Man and Return Of, which should actually probably be one book, and that would be a big book in terms of pages, but the sweep in that those two books...
Little Big Man's big enough on its own.
I mean, it is. The sweep of that book is magnificent. You mentioned your interest in East Asia. Have you done any stories based on the Asian traditions in terms of lore, say Japanese, you know, from Japanese tradition?
I have not written anything published that very directly deals with that. I did have a short story called Shard of Glass, which takes place in the 60s, and a significant portion of the story, it's about a mother and a daughter kind of running away from... a kind of literalization of white power in the U.S.
Where was that published?
It was published originally in Strange Horizons and then reprinted in Year's Best Fantasy VI, the Hartwell Kramer edition.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, in the most recent Datlow Windling effort, there is a wonderful story from the Japanese tradition, which
the Beastly
is
Bride.
Beastly Brides. It's a
I haven't read that one.
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, to me, it's as good as Tricks the Coyote Road. I mean, those are my two favorite in that series, and they have a story in there about a girl who is hidden away because of her looks. She's not typically Japanese, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful story.
Wait, which one was it?
That's the oh God. I wish I could something of.
Who's the author?
I don't remember. Hikikomori is the title, and. It's just, you know, just a beautiful story.
Given that we were just giving, sending that book to subscribers to WBA.
Oh, and well, all the stories in there, I mean, they're just absolutely wonderful.
And thank you, Ellen, by the way.
Yes, yes. Anyway.
Ellen's who rule my life, yes.
Anyway, Elia, very much success to you. I like the idea of vampires in the 20s with flappers.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Very cool. Good luck.
Thanks for calling.
And good morning. You're on the radio. Yellow.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, turn on your radio. Hello? You might find the delay a little confusing.
Okay. No, that's not it. It's other background noise.
Oh, okay.
The thing that I was going to ask about was, Castle in the Sky is also Hayao Miyazaki, and
yes.
It's also very good.
It's wonderful.
That one I've not heard of.
Castle in the Air, I think, is the U.S.
The thing
English
is
translation.
Huh?
I think the English translation is Castle in the Air, but I'm not sure. Go on, sorry.
Yeah, Castle in the Sky. Hayao Miyazaki, I recommend it really highly. There's just one caveat that comes with it. When you watch it, watch the original Japanese edition with the subtitles.
Okay.
Disney translated it into English, and they completely bunged the whole movie up. I mean, they changed the characters into idiots, they changed the plotting, they changed everything without actually changing anything. It was really interesting how they could completely screw up a movie without really changing.
Oh, that I feel like that is a rule for almost all anime. I don't watch dubs.
Yeah, I've been warned about that.
I just don't do it.
And that's for me is for any cinema actually.
Yeah, no, I find the concept of dubbing very strange.
I think they should give credit to who did the subtitles because even that can
right.
be. I recently hosted a screening of Kinzadza, which is a wonderful, bizarre Russian science fiction film, and I've seen two translations of it, and one of them a fan-subbed version. You have these characters very excited, and one of them, and the subtitle said, "Crikey!" And you know, later, okay, yeah, okay, somebody else might have said that differently.
Right. No, translation is always an art. Sorry.
And just out of curiosity, did you ever read a story called Oleg and the Thieving Cur?
No.
That sounds familiar, but no, I don't know that.
Oh.
Do you know who wrote it? Do you remember who wrote it?
John Coney. Me.
Okay. This is something you recommend?
Yes. I rather enjoyed it, but, you know, I would.
Okay, fair enough. That's valid.
Okay. It's about fairy tales and sort of another take on fairy tales.
Oh, well, that always fascinates me.
Yeah, I love fairy tale retellings, honestly. Though I've never written one.
Well.
Yet.
But I enjoyed the story. I dig the vampires. there was some vampire reference I was going to make, but I can't remember what it is, and I'll get off the phone so somebody else can talk to you.
Well, thanks for calling.
Thanks for calling.
Have a good morning.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And, yes, if you'd like to speak to Aliyah Dawn Johnson, 212-209-2900. Ooh, only 5 minutes left. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
I'm glad I made it. I was giving it the magic last try.
Right.
By the way, I absolutely loved the reading. And
thank you.
I thought I had been vampired out. You know, it's easy to sort of... So what you were saying about Western fantasy, it's nice to see somebody really doing something with it that's still enjoyable rather than just becoming this pervasive thing in the culture to the point where it becomes annoying. But genuinely enjoyed the reading.
Well, it's a fascinating question why vampire fiction has
yeah.
the legs it's got.
It's
we're going to deal with that in a future show.
I would enjoy hearing that. Did you, about... Oh, 2 weeks ago or maybe last week in the New Yorker, they had sort of a parody piece, and I think it was in Shouts and Murmurs, about talking about the way vampire fiction had come, and they were talking about angels, and I think it ended up being called Burning Wings or something.
Yeah,
it was like,
I saw that. I didn't read it yet, but I saw it because I subscribe.
Read it. It's like, you know, that's the next thing that's going to be just run into the ground.
Angels are definitely the next big thing. That is, it's actually my friend and roommate who works in publishing predicted that to me a year ago when she'd like gotten two or three Angel submissions at her office over the course of, I don't even know, it was like 2 days or something. They just got, and she said, you know, I think it's going to be Angels. And I swear, 2 or 3 days later, we just heard about like this slew of huge Angel book deals. And now if you go and look at like the YA section in the bookstores, there's quite a few Angel novels.
So I know where to go. It's Vampire Angels.
Fallen Angel novels. So obviously going to have to write, you know, Angels in the Crimean or something. But
we'll cycle all the way back around till Dragons.
yeah.
There were two things I wanted to put out. One's completely silly, one's actually serious. I had just watched Of Human Bondage, the Betty Davis, Leslie Howard film last night, and it put me in mind of something you were saying about how you can't tell, you know, the story in a film, or there's just not enough to take the novel.
Yeah.
What they did there was they just picked up the story arc at a point in the novel, and they just took what of the story that they could. What do you think of that approach? I mean, not even trying to do the whole novel, since you know you can't, but just going from chapter whatever to chapter whatever, you know, and trying to do that part of it well.
I think that approach could work a lot better. I don't think it could work for all books. I think sometimes they're just too contextual. But I would appreciate that a lot more, because I feel like it actually acknowledges, like, the limits of what you can tell visually and what you can, like, pack into a novel.
I think I'd also compare that to take a look at the two different versions of the movie Solaris, where obviously the Tarkovsky is a classic, but the Steve Soderbergh version is legitimate, although Lem didn't like either of them. And the thing is that each movie takes a look at a completely different view of the novel and concentrates on different aspects of the novel. Each one's very different, and both are faithful.
Basically,
to Lem.
I feel that film adaptations have to be willing to do different things in the book. They just have to be willing to cut in some way. Either like they cut it down and does some condense the story, or they cut different parts of it out and they just make that the whole book. Like the real failing, I think, of a lot of book to film adaptations is that they feel, for whatever reason, the need to like actually get the entire story into the actual entire movie, which is impossible. And so the things that end up happening get stranger and stranger and less like good movie. You know, just
yeah, it doesn't work because it, you know, to get like to a Chomsky thing that you were saying, you know, the medium is a condition of the message or of the artwork.
Yeah,
and I think that's very much the case. Just acknowledging reality.
We're right, about out of time, by the way.
Okay, let me be really brief. I want to put a silly question to the guest, the host, and the audience. Does Godzilla technically qualify as a dragon? And I'll leave that out there as a debate. This is a debate.
That's like, is Goofy a dog or a horse?
Godzilla is a ghost revenant of the nuclear age.
Okay.
Good answer.
Thank you.
There we go. Thank you.
Okay,
very much.
Thanks so much. Okay, we've got 1 minute left. And so first we have to tell you the website is...
AlayaDonJohnson.com.
Okay, and that's
AlayaDonJohnson.com. Although you can also get to it by AlayaJohnson.com. I own them both.
Okay.
So just go AlayaJohnson.com, AlayaJohnson.
Okay, and that will be the portal to all fine things, but let us name the books. Racing the Dark, which is
the first book of a fantasy trilogy, The Burning City, which is a sequel that just came out, and Moonshine, which is the start of a new 1920s vampire Lower East Side series.
Duology
for now. Who knows?
Duet, yes.
And thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And no, this will hardly be the last time. You'll be back as a participant, we hope, on August 8th, I believe.
Yes.
Next week is not set. The week after that, our guest will be Paolo Bacigalupi. And stay tuned for Simon Locally with As I Please. And everybody have a wonderful day. Enjoy the Mermaid Parade or whatever it is you're intending on doing today. And Alaya, again, much thanks.
Thank you.
Well, you are tuned to WBAI in New York City, 99.5 on your FM dial. So there. And good morning, and hello, and welcome to As I Please for this, the 19th day of June in the year 10. A Juneteenth, I believe. And my goodness gracious me, I can well understand if you're a bit out of sorts, because this is the first program without fundraising in well over a month. However, don't worry. If you miss the fundraising, David will be in at 8:30 with his usual brand of fundraising. And we assure you, that won't change. But I'm free. Yes, indeed, back to the way it should be. And just you, me, and a program that says all the things that we are supposed to be doing, and just out of reach. Does this work? Yes, indeed, a change is a-gonna come. Yeah, famous song. And certainly one of the changes happening next week, and I do hope you are properly prepared for the massive changes in New York City's transportation system, the elimination of bus lines and train lines, bye-bye W, so long V, the rerouting or rerouting of the M train, M as in massive mistake. All of this happening next Sunday, I believe. So do take this into account and be prepared. And do take a look at the brand new subway maps cropping up on the walls of subway stations now, with the new and improved Central Park, with the reservoir running the wrong way. I don't understand. Really, just freaks me out, man. I look at this, and there we are, middle of Manhattan, and there's this big blob of blue that runs east-west, not north-south. And I said, that's just wrong. That's just wrong. However, I am sure that there are plenty of people out there who are keen on the topic of cartography, and the history of the subway map is a fascinating history indeed. Well, I have a newspaper print here, and I can tell you one thing. And that's it. Yes, indeed. How about that? New map, new route, but the same old disappointments. Yes, we'll still be waiting forever for a train. I say restore the G-line, by gum, by gosh, by golly. That's the very least we could do. Now, let's see, just before I go, I just wanted to mention this because, you know, fundraising is over for me at least, but it perhaps lingers in your memory. Consequently, you may be interested to learn that a congressional investigation has determined that many of the herbal supplements available at fine health food shops around the world are contaminated. Indeed, they are finding traces of lead in that ginkgo leaf that you're swilling down now. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that this is the federal government warning us against these herbal supplements. And I dare say that at WBAI/Pacifica, we're saying they don't know what they're talking about. But I'm going to raise the question, you know, who knows? Who's in charge of these things anyway? So, I will twiddle my thumbs while waiting for more information on this. But remember, just because you're buying it in your health food shop does not necessarily make it entirely healthy. Herbal supplements are contaminated. Some are, at any rate. So, take care. Now, as oh, I gotta press the start button, huh? Jeez. Man. All right, that was... Well, I'm going to ignore all of this because it's really too complicated for a fellow like me. I'll just say, I'm not going to play much music this morning, and the music I do play, I will try to fill in later, but this is just insane. This is just insane. And as you know, I am very concerned about the insanitary conditions here at WBAI, and this is just one of them. Ah, to heck with it, right? Good morning, comrades. Welcome aboard. Try it again, but I'm telling you something. Really? Oh, it's frozen. Well, never mind then. Ken, if you have a moment, you can drop by. I have a question to ask you, which I'll be happy to do on the air or off the air, depending when you show up. Well, good morning. Hello. Welcome aboard. I do have something up my sleeve. I'll get to it in a moment, but I first wanted to do this, and this is important to one and all. So, are you listening? That's good, because if you're not listening, it makes the whole radio experience really quite pointless now, doesn't it? I want you to settle down and dig this, as we used to say. Okay, make sure everything's queued up. Everything's ready. Good. All right, I played this last week. I'm playing it again now. And I'm going to suggest that you may hear this a lot in the coming weeks. So, comfy, cozy. This is beautiful. Ha 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 ha